Hi everyone. Today I'm talking to Mindaugas Mozuras, who's a software developer and the VP of engineering at Vinted, the world's biggest fashion marketplace and Lithuania's first tech unicorn. During our conversation, we discussed Mindaugas' upbringing and his views on entrepreneurship, personal growth, and conflict resolution. Enjoy. Speaking of those disturbances, I mean, that's a great example in what age we live, where you start a conversation and on the third minute, you get a notification. So
yeah.
For a short, maybe X course, I like spontaneity. So what's your take on nowadays, how the communication is happening online?
So I'll start somewhere else. So I recently watched a movie, more than a couple of weeks ago. Some time ago, I watched a movie, and that I think the movie is still in theater, so people might be able to watch it in theaters too. The movie is called Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. It's my favorite movie of the year. I am well aware that I'm seeing it in June, but I cannot imagine that I'll watch something better. And the movie is really about that there are a lot of things coming at us, like everything, everywhere, all at once. And it's the main character takes a journey on how to deal with all those things, all those important things that are happening in our lives, how to make decisions about those things, how to focus on some specific things. So I think that movie is very timely. I think that's the age we live in. I think the information age made more things come at us. We receive more information. There's more information available to us. There are more things to focus on. And I think it's one of the challenges that we as humans have to deal with at this time. It's not an easy challenge to deal with, but it is a critical one in my eyes.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Everything Everywhere All at Once?
You're putting me under a spotlight because I saw somewhere that you enjoyed that film and I started watching it and I didn't understand what the fuck is going on here.
But I mean, there are a lot of things happening in that movie.
Exactly.
But again, it's in the title. It's in
exactly.
The title.
Exactly. And when I started watching it, I felt so overwhelmed, you know. I felt that I'm already anxious in general about things, about writing an article, about podcasting, about consulting. And now I'm watching a movie where I'm feeling even more anxious. And then I realized, okay, not this time, not on my vacation in Klaipeda.
Yeah, but like the movie does a brilliant job of putting the viewer in that mindset.
Exactly.
It's
interesting because there's like that discussion, you know, I once studied languages and literature, and there are certain like artists and creators that when they write something, for example, there's a novel written by Bret Easton Ellis about the title is American Psycho. There's also a film on that. And in that book, he basically, at that time when it was written, like 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot of product placements, you know, Gucci, you know, DAG, all these kind of things. And in that book, there are a lot of extensive descriptions on what characters are wearing, on what they are eating, how they look. And it's like more than half of the whole book. And when you're reading it, you get annoyed by that, but you realize that this is the reality at that time. And I'm not sure if that changed a lot since then, but you know, the author wanted to put the reader in that place where you're like reading a book as a, you know, fashion magazine, Vogue or something like that, you know? So yeah. What you're talking about that movie, I think the goal might have been similar to put the watcher is not a word.
Viewer.
The viewer, right? In a similar spot where you really get into that mood of being everywhere all at once, right? So speaking of that feeling, so would you say that you're in a similar place right now, everywhere all at once?
No, I think I do a decent job of focusing and saying no to certain distractions, and I think I do a decent job at prioritizing the things that I find the most important. I say decent job because I don't feel that I'm doing that perfectly. There are still situations where I feel a bit overwhelmed, but they don't happen daily. They happen sometimes. And I think due to the 2 years I spent in therapy, most of the times I feel that I'm able to recognize when I'm in those moments of feeling overwhelmed, and then I think I'm able to deal with those situations, notice that I'm overwhelmed, understand why I feel overwhelmed, and then I'm able to make decisions that move that feeling away from me. And in a lot of cases, of course, those decisions are about, okay, these are the six things that I'm thinking about right now. I can only think about three. I need to say to those other three people that I made commitments to or made promises or something, sorry, I won't be able to get to that today. I will get to that tomorrow, next week, sometime later. So those situations do happen. And, you know, when I think about that feeling of overwhelmness, for the lack of a better word, it mostly relates to work and sometimes to other kinds of commitments. I think I do a good job at controlling the information flow that's coming at me. You know, I don't watch news. I consume very
no news at all. Media. No Facebook, no like news portals, no TV, anything.
So yeah, I don't watch any TV news. Wow. I don't read the news portals. I do scroll sometimes on, and I see some news stuff in Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter.
Yeah.
But I do control the content there pretty firmly too. So there can be situations when I'm not aware of the things that are happening in the world. But usually I learn that through my friend's wife, someone else. If something is really, really important, I learn about it through other channels.
So what you were talking about, the ability to identify those aspects of overwhelmingness or something like that, and it seems that you were, from what you're saying, it seems that you learned to do that, to identify those triggers in therapy. And I would really like to talk about therapy as well, but if we would go back a bit to the early roots, as we said, those tendencies to feel overwhelmed, they are still somewhat related to the way we learn to appreciate, to perceive things, and what we see as important or not, at least is somehow related to how we are brought up. So for example, if I feel overwhelmed by work, I take on a lot of tasks, a lot of responsibilities, I give a lot of promises, it's a highly likely that at least one parent was somewhat similar. So we somewhat copied that behavior, or we were trained, for the lack of a better word, by our parents to be responsible, to be accountable. It's somewhat related to the feeling, to the personality trait of conscientiousness. Now, there's another problem where people feel also overwhelmed, but they don't have that conscientiousness to deal with that overwhelmingness, right? And it's another problem where people grow up without these necessary skills, especially today when you have to control a lot of things to feel at least somewhat sane in this world, right? At least somewhat sane. So how would you describe your upbringing? In other words, what were the things you feel you took from your parents? What are the things that you would like not to have taken from them? How would you describe that?
That's not an easy question to answer, but I think I will first go to my brother and not to my parent, because I think that the relationship that I had with my brother in my childhood, and I still have a very good relationship with my brother now,
is really fundamental to how I grew up. Well, and of course, in addition to the example my parents said and the things that I took from them. Because like one of the first memories I have of my childhood is actually me and my brother in the living room, I think, like building a road to the other room. And when I say building a road, it's using anything really to build that road. Like just, I don't know, shoes, for example, and just putting stuff together so that, you know, our cars, I'm not even sure if we had cars, but those cars could travel from the living room to the kitchen. And then this is one of the first memories I have of my childhood. I'm not sure how old I was at that time, but I think it already, when I look back at that memory, it really shows some of the things that I still do at work today, you know, building stuff.
If I can stop you here a bit, when you describe that building the road from point A to point B, it sounded like basically your role of being a VP of engineering, bringing the company from point one to point two.
Sure. There are similarities, but it's not just building stuff. It's really building stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
Because the collaboration aspect is also something that I care a lot about in my work life. It's not just me sitting down and doing something. It's us doing something.
Sure.
And having that relationship with my brother in my childhood and working together with him and how we always tried to do something together. It was not just, you know, Mindaugas telling his little brother, do this.
So he was younger than you?
Yeah, he's younger than me.
Okay.
But we always had that collaborative mindset when we were playing together, despite me being a couple of years older.
Yeah, that's important because sometimes that's an unfortunate reality where people don't have siblings. They sometimes lack that ability to collaborate, to share, especially if they did not attend kindergarten, which sometimes happens. So in your case, it seems that you had a good partner to learn from each other. What was the age gap between the two of you?
So the age gap is 2 years and 2 months. I'm okay. 2 years and 2 months older. And we had a lot of room to collaborate. So in our family, we were really left often to our own devices and to figure things for ourselves. So it was more often than not that we were doing something together with my brother, and less often, you know, my parents got involved and said, you should be doing this, go out and play football together. It's more often than not, me and my brother were figuring out that ourselves.
Did you spend time like at home mostly, or would you go outside on the street spending time with other kids? How was it like when you were small?
It's a mix. I think we spent, well, when we were younger and did not have a computer at home,
okay,
it was definitely more often outside. I think later, when we got older and had a computer at home and computer games became a thing, that balance shifted a little bit.
How old were you when you got your first computer?
So the first computer at home, I was already in school, so it must be something like I was like 8 years old, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And of course, in those early days, there were not a lot of games to play, or they were fairly simplistic. And I'm pretty sure that like we did not have the top end computer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
and we only had a PC. We yeah. never had a console, a gaming console at home. Okay. So that's another aspect. I think that was a conscious choice on our parents' part. Well, I would have to ask them how conscious it was.
Yeah, because those Zillaton computers were not that expensive. Yeah, at least I had one. I didn't have Sega, which was more like high-end at the time. But Zillaton, yeah. it was like at every home, basically, where we're boys.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah I can, like, I don't know, but I can imagine our parents having a discussion on whatever that, mm-hmm. like a purely gaming computer is something they want to have at home. I can definitely imagine my parents making a conscious choice that we should not do this and let's just have a PC. There are going to be games on it, but you can also do some other stuff on it. So that might have been a fair trade-off. And of course, later as computers became more powerful, you know, you could do a lot of gaming on a PC. But that came later, and I was a bit older when me and my brother really got into gaming. Like the first computer game that I really remember spending a ton of time on, I think, was Diablo 2.
Oh,
so I think that's like 2000, year 2000. So I was something 13 like that. At that time.
Mm-hmm. I already I remember that ominous music, that ominous soundtrack.
Yeah,
sounds without like classical guitars. I think like those middle-aged yep. vibe music. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Diablo 3 was in my honest opinion, it was a mess. But it's a different topic. We should not get.
Sure.
So you know when parents decide to buy a computer, so. What were, in your case, the reasons doing that? Do you remember, like, were your parents somehow related to computers, or they just felt that, okay, it would be reasonable to have such a machine at home for news or something like that? What was, do you think, their motivation to buy such a device?
So the first computer we had, first of all, did not have an internet connection.
Yeah, I realize. So
definitely not news.
Okay.
I don't know what the discussion was. I was 8 years old and I was not participating in that discussion. So I'm not sure what the decision-making process was there. I can imagine it was partly work, partly maybe, yeah. But I would be speculating on what the exact reasons were.
But
I don't think they were thinking long-term that, you know, this is something that will grow and become more important in the world.
Okay.
Because my parents did not have any direct connection with computers.
I see. So can you say what their professions were at the time when you were getting into computers or gaming and something like that?
So my mother, she was a teacher, and then during the early childhood, she decided to help raise us. And then my father was running a small business.
A teacher and a businessman. Interesting. So where do you think you got the roots for problem solving engineering, which you eventually went to when you became older? What do you think?
So of course it's difficult to pinpoint exactly, but you know, the games we played with my brother, I'm not talking about computer games, like physical stuff, right? Like I remember us playing things like ball games, basketball, football, etc. outside. But I also distinctly remember many times, and those memories are really vivid, right? Like building stuff and, you know, building like my first memory is building a road. Like I have distinct memories of playing with various Legos or something akin to Legos, and not just, you know, putting together things according to the instruction set, but building all kinds of random things, like building, just random and different, and deciding, okay, today we're gonna build like a huge tall tower out of everything we have. Mm-hmm. Let's see where that gets us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And did you feel?
And I think that, mm-hmm. I think that there is the connection between building and then going into building software.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that your parents were like positive about the fact that you were like building stuff, doing engineering, or maybe they were critical, or they were just neutral about it? As you say, they left you doing your own stuff and not minding too much about your activities.
Well, you know, they made choices on what kind of toys to buy us, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So they made those choices. I don't think they were thinking like long term, this is
Mindaugas will be AVP of engineering or the first unicorn in Lithuania. Let's do some strategy about it.
Exactly. I don't think there was any kind of strategy involved.
Sure.
I think they were just picking something that they thought is cool and that we would enjoy. Maybe would involve some thinking and would challenge us a little bit. Maybe there was part of that involved, but I don't think that they were thinking long term on what kind of prospects that could create for us.
Okay.
And you know, funnily enough, my brother is an architect, so there is a definite connection between Indeed. Building stuff during childhood and what he's doing now.
Yeah, it's important for parents to be able to identify the passions of their children and provide games or toys that would reinforce that joy. And it's a process that you have to be very mindful of, because you know it can, as you can see, as we can see, to build a how to say, to provide ground for career decisions and related things. Speaking of life in general, you know, I'm sure that there were many other experiences that might have contributed to your decision to become a software developer. And are there any like key moments in your life that you would also, you know, dedicate to your assigned to your choice that might have had influence on your choices later on when you were choosing a profession? Any specific experiences? What do you think?
So we had an IT class in school, but I don't think that IT class had a very big influence on me choosing software engineering later. I think it was just like the primary reason I was considering software engineering is the fact that, you know, we had a computer at home. I enjoyed doing things on the computer. I was reading about how to potentially create video games myself. I think that a lot of engineers get into software engineering because they imagine building a computer game themselves. Maybe a bit less now, because there are more examples of what you can build, more exciting examples of what you can build. You can build like exciting other kinds of software tools, not just games. I mean, sure. Those examples were less exciting 10 years ago, 20 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. But even as I was playing around with these ideas, I was not considering software engineering as a serious career choice.
Okay.
Like my parents were really more like influencing me towards a direction like maybe something related to economics, maybe law, something, you know, serious. And I did not grasp like 3 months until I think something like 3 months until I needed to make the choice which universities I'm going to apply to. I think even 3 months until I had to make the choice, I did not fully grasp that I could seriously go into software engineering. I did not grasp that it's a valid career choice, like something more than just a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
Something that has a lot of potential. I did not grasp that until very late. And I have to thank my friend who also got into software engineering for helping me understand that. Because I had a classmate who was really set on going into software engineering, and through his example and through things he said to me, I then came to understand, oh, okay, this is something I can actually do. This has good prospects, and this is something that I do enjoy doing, because I was doing some programming.
That's cool.
When I programming in school in outside of, even mm-hmm. a bit outside of school.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, because nowadays getting into tech or IT in general is very fashionable, and we sometimes forget that at some particular time it was not that fashionable. Geeks were like bullied for the fact that they were too much interested into computers. They looked strange. Like if you look at Bill Gates back in the day, so they were not those fashionable, sexy entrepreneurs that everyone would like to become. Like, for example, Elon Musk right now, he's a geek if you look at him, but on the best possible way, on the best possible sense of that word. Was there like any pushback back in the day when you were considering this opportunity? And when do you think you might have felt that, okay, it's sexy to be a software developer, or maybe it's attractive to be a software developer, that it's like also like being an economist, lawyer, maybe physician? Where do you think that switch happened? What do you think
in your experience? So in my school, I received no pushback for being into computers. I
think
at least the group of children that I interacted a lot with in school were like excited about computer games really early on. Okay. So there was no pushback there. And so I did not experience anything of the sort.
Okay.
But it's a good question of when I understood that software engineering is sexy, let's say, for the lack of a better word. It was definitely after I finished university, not earlier. But it's difficult to pinpoint the exact time.
And what was the year when you graduated?
What year did I graduate? So I was born in 87. So I was 18 in 2005. So 2009, 2010, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing my math correctly.
Yeah, and we have to bear in mind the fact that we're based in Lithuania, and trends that might have been, let's say, in states, cultural connotations about being a programmer might have been different in our case. We were basically in everything late in the game. So it's glad that we might have maybe did not have that bad experience of maybe, okay, these are those sports jockeys and these are the geeks. And there's like that toxic environment where, for example, just because you're into computers and games, you are somehow not a cool kid. I think I didn't have also this problem, because it was okay to play games, computer games. It was like being, you know, belonging to the gang. I played Counter-Strike for quite a while, so we would even get into teams and compete against each other. So there was like that team aspect that you might see, and you do see in software engineering. So there were those roots, and it was totally positive. Of course, on the side of the parents, my parents did not enjoy the fact that I spend a lot of time playing games, although I was good at school. But there was not like that it's a bad thing, you know. It's just, okay, don't spend too much time. It's bad for your eyes, just for that reason, you know. So
I think that When I think back on when I understood that being a software engineer might be sexy, it would probably relate something to my salary, because at some point, you know, software engineering is a very well paid career at this point, and has been a very well compensated career for a while. And, you know, at some point, even, you know, I started working as a software engineer in the second year of university, and my salary increased, well, quite rapidly. I did not fully realize how rapidly compared to like everyone else, especially those who are not software engineers. But at some point, that, you know, salary reached something that is, okay, I'm still very young, but I'm earning this decent amount of money. So this is okay. Like this is really something that's cool. Maybe I would not use the word sexy. but it made me understand. Okay, this is something valuable mm-hmm. at this point of time. You know, maybe it will not be as valuable 10 years from now, or well, we can see that it still is. But like I had. I was not expecting that it would become even more popular than it was at that point. Mm-hmm. But I think it was something for me. It was something related to that, which was a very tangible way to understand that something I chose is very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Speaking of money. Just a question from top of my mind. Did you at any point in your life have had money issues?
I wouldn't say that at any point in time I had money issues. What I do remember about my childhood is that my father really tried to make us, me and my brother, understand the value of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember distinct instances of when he tried to convey some specific lessons about how to treat money.
Okay.
And I remember like really being really, and I still have that today, really being really conservative with money.
Okay.
So, you know, trying to save money to buy something good, and not just like saving money for a week to buy something cool on the weekend, like saving money for 6 months. Like, maybe my grandparents gifted me some money. Maybe I saved some from school, something else. And then half year later, I can buy this thing. Oh. I remember those lessons from mm-hmm. my childhood, but yeah, I wouldn't say that there was any at any point in time when I had problems with money or that I felt that I don't have enough money.
A money issue to me is not only not having money, but also being overwhelmed by money. When you earn mm-hmm. too much too early, can be overwhelming. At least it was to me. Then I was working as a tech recruiter and my annual revenue was doubling every year. And also I felt that, and I'm glad that I also had that conservative, as you say, attitude, because it helped me save those profits. And you know, now I'm able to buy a relatively good real estate. Although I'm not working as a recruiter anymore, I'm not earning those sums. And now I think it ties well to another topic we were thinking of talking about, is entrepreneurship or leadership in general. What do you think the fact that you were conservative about money might have helped you or not to be, let's say, a good leader, like C-suite leader at that level? What were maybe the pros of that and cons of that conservatism in a startup world? What do you think?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if there's a direct connection between me being conservative with money and me being a, you know, VP of engineering.
Oh, no, I will specify what I mean. Just let me specify what I mean. Just the fact that you are conservative, and let's say you have the leverage to do certain things with money. Let's say how many engineers to hire, how to expand the business, what technologies to use. Everything usually boils down to, okay, what do you invest, what you buy, what you don't. And at that leadership role, you make these decisions. So how would you like psychoanalyze yourself, the fact that you are on the one hand conservative, but at the same time you are working in an environment where, let's say, I'm not speaking of your current company, but in general, there's a very somewhat easygoing way about investing money, burning it on stuff, and etc.
Well, I wouldn't say that we have an attitude at Vinted that, you know, we can spend money very easily. I don't think that's the reality. The reality at Vinted is that we are very cost conscious, because we're in a business that, you know, most of our members, most of the people who use Vinted, a lot of them use it for the reason that the things that they can buy on Vinted are cheaper than the things they could buy firsthand. So they can buy a pair of Nikes that are used, but they will be significantly cheaper than if they were to look for them in the first-hand market. So our members are cost conscious. Oh, and then what we need to do as a business, we also need to be cost conscious, because we cannot create a value proposition to our members that would be very expensive. Like, shipping needs to be cheap.
Okay.
Like, we need to run our servers cost consciously, because if we spend a lot of our servers, we will need to transfer those costs in some way to our customers, so that we would be able to maintain those servers. I would say that at Vinted we are quite cost conscious. That jabs quite well with the mindset I have about finance in my personal life.
There's that alignment. Yeah,
there is some of that alignment, but then there are also differences, right? Because when I'm thinking about what teams do we need to hire, I do need to think about those opportunities more than I think about opportunities to spend money in my personal life. Like, in my personal life, it's really more about, okay, these are the things that we need to buy for our family, like food, okay, et cetera.
Sure.
And this amount of money we're gonna put into, like, some kind of safe investment account or something like that. And I don't really chase opportunities. Like, I'm not doing stock picking. Which I know that some people do. Like, I don't spend time trying to find ways to create opportunities in my personal life with money.
Why don't? But Vinted, if we stop here, why don't?
It's not a priority. I don't think that's, like, my priority. And this is a very conscious choice I made quite early on in my career. I think it was influenced by some blog posts I read, maybe even a book that I read. There were some influences, but I made a conscious choice that my focus is going to be as great of as a software engineer as I could be. And that's where I want to put, but that's what I really want to focus on. Instead of, you know, I'm going to focus 100% of becoming a good software engineer, instead of 50% good software engineer, 25% decent stock picker, 25% something else. And that's, you know, that's kind of how I think about it to this day. Of course, there are other focus points in my life But I do try to limit the amount of focus points that I have. Like, I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good VP of engineering, but I don't, but I really try to consciously limit the amount of things that I focus on. So,
yeah, it's interesting that.
It doesn't enter my mind.
It totally makes sense what you're saying. And it seems that you are focusing your attention and efforts to where you would like to grow and achieve your personal or family goals or professional goals or whatever. And you know, many people, they get into those, as you said, stock pickings or crypto or related, not necessarily to become good stock pickers, but to earn money in an easier way. I mean, it's also a problem, I guess, why many young entrepreneurs want to create a startup because they want a sellout. They just want to grow quickly and just leave the game entirely, you know? And I mean, it's interesting. What's your take on that? Because let's be honest, you are in that startup world and you are at a highly competitive level. I'm sure that you speak to many young people who had these ideas, who had these visions, who maybe want to leave the internet or any other company and create their own startup. Sure, there are people who are on a mission, but it's not like everyone, you know. So what's your take on it's still tied somewhat to money. Why is the case that people want that, they want to win the game just for the sake of winning it?
Mm-hmm. So first of all, what I say is that, where should I start? Let me think.
Okay.
When I think about these sort of things, I do understand that people can earn big rewards if they decide to go into stocks. The way that I look at it, first of all, is that we all have a very limited amount of time. I do understand that there's a opportunity to become rich quicker if you do get lucky by going into stock picking, for example. My thinking around that was, when I made that conscious choice to really invest into becoming a good software engineer and like focus on that instead of having multiple focuses, is that in the long term, in the very long term, that is likely to be a better outcome for me, both like personally and also financially. So I was thinking about the long term when I made that choice. And then on entrepreneurs, I think I agree that there are quite a few different motivations that lead people into becoming entrepreneurs. Some people become entrepreneurs because they see a problem they want to solve. And it can be a very big problem, maybe something like sustainability. Other people just see an opportunity to build something that will be financially lucrative. And I think it's fine. It's a fine motivation. It's a different kind of motivation. But if someone sees an opportunity to build a valuable business that like in 5 years will actually be a feature on some bigger platform, and that bigger platform will want to acquire you because you've built that feature successfully, I think that's a fair reason. That's not the way that I can think. Like, that's not how I function. I would not be able to do that. It's just not me. But for me, it's still a completely valid reason to go into entrepreneurship, because you will still be building something valuable. You will be creating value in the world, hopefully. In some cases, you will be unsuccessful, of course, but the attempt will be to create something valuable.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, value sounds great, but you know, value is not equals value, if you know what I mean. I mean, if we want to, you know, just a important but maybe silly example, to reduce poverty, fair enough. If that's the value we're striving for. But if you just want to create a additional need for a product that we don't necessarily need, like on a psychological level. So for example, do we need, just an example, do we need Instagram? I don't know. Like, now we need, because we are somewhat dependent on the outlet to express ourselves. But in actuality, do we actually need Instagram, or do we need Facebook? Or do we need another product that we got used to because, you know, someone created it and thought that it would be useful? So, you know, I'm not sure if that's something you would like to discuss. Just tell me if that's not your cup of tea. But, you know, I guess I feel somewhat skeptical or critical about rationalizing that you're creating value with your startup, whether it's like crypto or sustainability, or maybe just general fintech stuff. I still feel that's my psychological, you know, hunch. I still feel that a lot of it boils down to prestige, money, accomplishments, all those kind of things that are somewhat covered under nice values, nice visions, nice ideas. And I'm not sure if that's something you ever explore, that unconscious urge to win, to succeed, to, but yeah, I'm interested just in your take on that, because I feel that it's something that is not, it's talked about, but not in a proper way. What do you think?
So I think that another thing that's relevant about me to this conversation is that I'm an optimist. So I believe, like with my whole heart and body, that in the long run, everything's going to be good. And when I look back at, when I look at the situation in the world today, like there are quite a few bad things going on, but I'm someone who looks at that and really believes in the ability of humanity to solve all these issues and to come out stronger on the other end.
So Mindaugas, what would be that good in your estimation?
What is good for humanity?
Yeah, because you mentioned you think that everything will be good. So, well, what is that good in your estimation?
So that's something that, you know, very, very difficult to define exactly. But, you know, but just to give a specific example, I do believe that as humanity, we're going to solve the climate crisis we're living through today. And the good of that will be that humanity will continue to thrive. Okay. I think that's, maybe good is the wrong word, but
we will exist longer in a way.
At least we will exist longer, and we will continue to explore the galaxy and find what is out there. I'm trying to remember what was the topic we had before. Entrepreneurs.
Money. To me, I'm still struggling with that money issue.
Yeah. So in Instagram, right? I think there's a good argument to be made that in the long run, the social platforms we have today are not a positive thing for humanity. I'm not confident on what's the answer here, because there's a lot of nuance. There's not just two choices. We all use social platforms, or social platforms don't exist. There's a lot of in options in between. That's one thing. But the second thing is that I believe that as humans, we will solve this and we will figure out what works best for us. And when I say we will solve this, it's not just those companies and us as users. Like, we have systems in place that help us create various rules, legislation that lead to better outcomes overall. So I think that there are many angles we're trying to tackle these the issues, for example, with the social platforms.
Yeah, I hear you. And you're definitely optimistic because the legislation that we have is not prospective, it's retrospective. Legal, how to say, laws, they follow events. And oftentimes events are quicker than the laws we create. And I guess I'm not sure if that's a good discussion point for today, but there are some people who criticize European Union for, how to say, putting constraints or innovation of artificial intelligence. Some people criticize that we are somewhat, how to say, pressuring big tech companies like Google or Facebook or whatever. And they say that it's like boiling down, it's like repressing innovation.
Yeah, but and I think
but those, so just to finish, just to finish, and you know, and what you're saying is that okay, so we should just keep the existing legislature and whatever happens, we will leave it somewhat safe. Yeah.
Yeah, so those points are fair, but when I'm talking about, I'm taking an even longer view.
Okay.
So I'm not just talking about like the current legislation and what like the current legislative bodies are trying to do with the social platforms. I'm talking like I'm quite optimistic and confident that in the very long run, we'll figure out what works best for us. I don't know how long it will take for us. Five more years, 10 more years, 15 more years. I don't know exactly, but I'm sure we'll figure it out. And there are downsides in the meantime, but I think that's the reality of the beast. Like specifically right now, we're experiencing a lot of innovation and a lot of new things with information technology. It would be impossible to expect for legislators to be able to create good rules following those innovations. That's just not possible. And I'm sure that there's going to be legislations that are not productive, and those will need to be rolled back. That will happen too. To mistake is quite human.
I mean, that's the problem, that to roll back legislation is a awfully difficult thing to do. To create a legislation is one thing, but to roll back, it's even more difficult. I mean, of course, we would have to talk to law people, but, you know, just to get back to your optimism, you know, something in me says that I like this quality of yours, Mindaugas, and I guess we need more optimism nowadays because there's a lot of, you know, talk about dystopian futures, and I'm one of those people who are maybe I'm not saying that I'm not optimistic, I'm optimistic and pessimistic. There are certain areas in our progress that I enjoy, for example, that we are getting into wars less, although we have a war still in the Baltic region in Ukraine, unfortunately, but still on a general note, we have less war, less poverty, although we might have more poverty once again due to war nowadays. But still, it seems that there is good progression. We get new technologies. People are living better. They feel better. But at the other front, you know, we get these technologies that maybe are not necessarily solving the problem. They're just creating additional problems, you know. And I guess what I would like to hear from you is where you get this optimism. What's the well where you're drawing that optimism?
It's history. It's just purely looking at the history of humanity.
Okay.
And seeing that, you know, I'm not saying that bad things did not happen or still do not happen. They do happen. But we made positive progress year after year as humans, and we will continue to make progress. Will we make mistakes? Absolutely. Will bad things still happen? Yes, sadly. But the world is, if you really zoom out, the world is becoming better every year. And I'm positive that we're going to figure out the and solve the problems that we're currently facing.
Okay. I mean, I love your optimism, but we'll see how it turns out. Speaking of optimism, the way we feel optimistic or positive about things, it's somehow related, or at least related to the political or business environment we're in. There are certain leaders that give us optimism and hope, and there are certain leaders that, let's say, don't give us that optimism or hope. And I guess it's important to have such voices like you who are, let's say, who are those optimistic voices, because I feel that we need that. Now, speaking of those voices, let's say on a bigger scale, like voices like Elon Musk or, for example, Bill Gates. And these are two people who I feel that are investing a lot of their money and efforts to create an optimistic future or to provide ground for an optimistic future. So Bill Gates on the vaccination front, public health, Elon Musk maybe on existence in general, you know, space travel, electric cars, and all these kind of things. But I'm not sure if that's a good conclusion. But when we see Bill Gates, to me, he seems like, on a numbers level, he seems like more successful, and he's doing strides in what he's doing. At the same time, a lot of people hate on him. There's a lot of conspiracy around these things. Now, when we look at Elon Musk, I see, at least in the tech world, a lot of optimism about him and about his products. Although when you look at numbers, that there's a lot of nuance. So why do you think that we trust certain leaders and we distrust others, despite the fact that facts are much more complicated than just how they speak and how they look at things? In general, what do you like Elon Musk, Bill Gates, and do they give you inspiration, or maybe they are other figures? And well, what's your take on that?
Inspiration is a strong word, so I wouldn't say that any of them inspire me.
Okay.
But to be fair, I use the words "you inspire me" or "think about humans who inspire me." Like that's to me, that's like a very strong emotion. Okay. Like that feels like a very strong emotion that I just feel very, very rarely. That word represents something very strong for me. Like I look at them as, you know, humans. Who have flaws, who make mistakes, and I said that I'm optimistic. I'm also very optimistic about just other humans in general. So when I think about other humans, I default to assuming good intentions. So I assume that if someone's doing something, they have good intentions behind those acts. That is not always the case, but I live with those miscalculations, let's say. I would rather assume that people are good and have good intentions or are positive than the other way around. Mm. So I default to good intentions, and you know, occasionally I will get hurt because of that, but I'm okay with that trade-off. And I think that way about these entrepreneurs you named too. I assume that all of them have good intentions. I also understand that they're humans, so they will make certain missteps. But then again, I'm also not someone who follows news very closely, as I said before. So I also don't feel that I really know what is the mindset around these people in the popular media.
Yeah,
I hear some of it, but if you would ask me, like Jeff Bezos, how positive is he viewed these days? I would have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, good point, what you're saying. And I appreciate your humbleness in this. If you don't know something, you don't discuss it. That totally makes sense. At the same time, you know, it's once again, a podcast about happiness. And as you said, inspiration is a strong word. And for some people, let's say Elon Musk is a great inspiration. It's an inspiration to me. And the reason why he inspires me, so not necessarily for the reason for the products he creates, I appreciate on that front, but I mostly appreciate his attitude and personality. He's someone who is not afraid to be himself. He likes to troll sometimes people. He sometimes likes to be funny. He likes to, you know, make big statements. And some people say, oh, he's not serious. He's you know, decided to buy Twitter. Now he's reconsidering the decision. So some people don't think that he's a serious guy. But at the same time, you know, it once again boils down to that money topic we discussed. For some reason, I tend to like people who are open about their intentions and who are aware of their intentions and who are afraid to be stupid or look stupid and say what they actually want to achieve. And if, let's say, people have egoistic goals, I would like them to see, okay, I have an egoistic goal. I just want to be filthy rich. That's my goal. Take it or leave it, you know. But unfortunately, it's not the case. A lot of leaders, tell me how you see it in your corporate environment, but there's a lot of sugarcoating. There's a lot of like optimistic talk, but I'm not sure if there's enough authenticity that, okay, we want to be a successful business. Yes, we want to compete. Yes, we want to win. Yep, we like that. We enjoy that. But nope, we have to sugarcoat it. We have to use lozenges, big words, you know, and just rationalize what we're doing. So again, it just boils down to psychotherapy as well. Why I respect people who go into psychotherapy, because they are more able to be themselves and talk easier about their needs, expectations, motivations. And I would like to see all that more on that social media front. And I feel that what Elon Musk has is that authenticity, and which is missing in many leaders in corporate talk or whatever. So maybe you have an opinion on authenticity and what's authenticity to you, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. So authenticity is very important. I personally find it very important. It's something that I look for in other humans, that I appreciate in other humans I interact with, something that I appreciate in the leaders that I work with, and something that I do appreciate in public personalities. At Vinted, we do try to make authenticity into something that we value as a company. We really say to everyone that we want everyone to bring their authentic self to work. Everyone who works at Vinted, that they would be able to be their authentic selves when they work at Vinted. They wouldn't need to hide behind some kind of a mask when they work at Vinted. So authenticity is both important to me personally and to the company that I work for. I am authentic most of the time, I hope. At least I feel like I am. It's funny that sometimes people, when I'm, well, I feel that I'm just being myself, people actually, there are situations where people interpret that as being a bit faking.
Okay.
Maybe situations when I'm being a bit more on the, what's the word? Maybe eccentric side. So overall, yeah, authenticity is quite important. And I do agree. And I think the definition you gave, just being yourself, is I don't know if there's a better definition.
Yeah, but that's a problem that many people don't know themselves. And I'm not sure if it's making me not an optimist, but, you know, there is always the dark side to us everywhere. And I guess I feel safer next to people who are aware of their dark side and they are able to express their maybe certain needs that they not tend to talk about, let's say, in a corporate world. And when I worked in different companies, I didn't feel that. I guess my expectation or for benchmark for authenticity is higher, I guess. So talking about hobbies or what I did during the weekend, to me, it's not authenticity. Even now, talking about that I go to therapy, already it doesn't seem that, sometimes it can look like a show off because, oh, I'm fashionable because I'm going to therapy. So
we're at that point with therapy.
I'm not sure.
I think that's great.
I'm not sure. No, I'm working as a counselor. I see people who come to me. I don't see those who don't. So I'm very biased in this regard. But a lot of people say to me that I came to therapy because I think that it's a good thing. Sure.
Okay. They're not giving like a specific reason.
They give certain reasons what they want to grow on. We define that because otherwise I would not be able to work. What are their goals? What are their problems or issues or whatever? But they oftentimes say, I come to therapy because I think that it's a good thing. So it's like, I'm not sure. Yeah. What is a healthy thing to do? But not necessarily that you have to do. You know, I swim because I think that it's a healthy thing to do. I mean, yeah, but I swim because I want to become stronger. I want to swim because I want to compete. I want to swim because I enjoy the process. That's a reason. And yeah, sometimes,
it seems that in those cases, they're not able to fully articulate the reason that they're going to therapy. I assume. Because I would guess that they have a reason why they came. Maybe that reason is even something like their friend recommended it to them and they've seen their friends change in a really positive way and they want something like that for themselves too. Like, I can't imagine many different reasons why people go to therapy.
Well, what about you?
To me, it sounds like they are not capable to articulate it really.
It's possible. It's a good hypothesis. But speaking of you, so are you still in therapy? Because you're relatively open about the fact that you would go to therapy. Are you still in therapy?
No, I'm not. I'm not in therapy anymore. But okay. Like, it's at this point, it's more of a tool that I have in my toolbox. If I need it, I will go to therapy again. I feel that I understand the benefits that I can get in therapy, like the understanding of myself better. By the way, the fact that they're not able to articulate the reason well, very well, why they are going into therapy is a good, might be a good reason to go to therapy.
Exactly. Because
then you get to know yourself better. Maybe sure. You can articulate those reasons really better. Like maybe you're unconsciously trying to copy your friend who went into therapy.
Yeah. I mean, usually, so that's the good part about it. Even if someone comes with the unconscious reason to become as everyone else, or to adapt to the social environment, to adapt to the fashions, it's still a good starting point because a person will usually find the area that one would like to improve on. So I totally agree. I guess my critique was of the fact that, I mean, the idea of balance, I guess there's always a limit. There is, yes, sustainability is great. Talking about mental health is great. Making the world better is great. Optimism is great to a certain point. Mm-hmm. There is no, like, as you said, black and white thinking in this regard as well, you know. And, you know, sometimes people come because they think that they need therapy, but when they realize after several sessions that they don't, they feel better about it.
Well, wait, what do you mean?
Because sometimes their environment thinks that they need therapy. Okay. And they push them to do a work that they don't necessarily want or need.
Yeah.
And that's also a problem. And nothing should be taken for face value. Therapy has its own limitations. It takes time. It's pricey. It's difficult. It can bring up things that you might find it difficult to deal with in your current life. So you have to be really aware, why do you need it? And okay, it's a positive thing, but it can be a negative thing. So, you know, it's a someone who speaks is a psychologist and who goes to therapy. So, you know, I'm not criticizing. Yeah, I am a psychologist. I like therapy. I enjoy it. Maybe enjoy it is a bad word. I like the outcomes of it. But there are certain situations and you don't need it, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a very fair point. One other thing that I have about myself is that I don't usually like generalizations. I'm immediately suspicious of statements like everyone needs to do X. Like, I just something immediately triggers in me that's like, this is suspect. I'm not sure this is true. And there might be cases when it is true, but it is a trigger for me. So of course I agree with the statement that not everyone needs to go to therapy. It's a very useful tool to be aware of. It's worth understanding the potential benefits or the potential situations it might be worth going into therapy for. I'm happy that people are more aware of therapy's existence and that you don't need to wait for a huge crisis to go into therapy. I think that is a very positive thing that we have going.
Yeah, that's also a good point, because, you know, it's like exercise. You don't have to go to a gym because you have a, let's say, knee trauma, I want to improve on your knee. So it's okay to exercise because you enjoy the process and you want to prevent maybe certain illnesses in the future. So it's a good question, you know, if therapy is a good preventive tool. You know, I'm also a coach and it's a different profession that might sometimes be more suitable than therapy, because sometimes therapy might be seen as corrective and oftentimes it is. It corrects things, but not necessarily helps you improve. But I guess it's a different topic. Speaking of you, Mindaugas, I'm still interested. So on that therapy front, so, you know, as an engineer, you know, I appreciate that you went to therapy and we can talk about the outcomes you got from therapy. But I realized that you talked about it in previous outlets. But if speaking of therapy, like from an engineering point of view, which I'm curious, you know, there are a lot of problems with therapy that should be improved. So first of all, becoming aware that you're improving can be a problem. The variety of methods that are working, like, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy, psychoanalytic therapy, existential therapy, gestalt therapy, systems therapy, family therapy, blah, 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 blah. A lot of schools, a lot of tools. Research shows everything is more or less the same. But tools are different. It's like in engineering frameworks. okay, we have, let's say on front end, I'm not sure, React, Vue, Angular. But if you look at the plethora of therapies, too many. So second problem. Third problem, prejudices regarding therapy. Very bad ideas about a lot of misconceptions. So I could name even more, but from your perspective, what were maybe the issues with therapy that you, and I don't expect you to criticize, but from your personal experience, what do you think could have been better from the engineering perspective and how we could improve it? Let's brainstorm. I would love to hear your thoughts about it.
So the main challenge I had with therapy is that I didn't need recommendations. So I had an event, me and my girlfriend at the time got separated, and people recommended therapy to me, but it was not something that I was aware of at the time as a possibility. So I needed that recommendation from people I trust to become aware of the tool itself. I was also lucky that I got recommended a therapist who I really clicked with
immediately.
I know that it was very easy to have conversations with my therapist. Like I found it very easy to open up to her. So and I do understand that I got lucky by having people in my life who were aware of therapy, who could even recommend a specific therapist for me, because two different people recommended the same therapist for me. And that recommendation,
interesting.
And then even more successfully, that recommendation worked. So I got lucky multiple times through this process. And you talked about it, there are too many choices. I'm not sure if there are too many choices. Maybe different people like different kind of process. That's fine. But I do think that there might be some opportunity to make the discovery even easier. And then when I say discovery, it's not just being aware that there are therapists out there, but discovering what will work for you. I do know of examples where people go and try to find a therapist that will work for them, and it takes multiple tries to find that relationship that works.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And marketplaces, like for example, I hear you pasikalbėk in Lithuanian or Mindletic, they allow you to go to one place and compare different specialists according certain criteria. So for example, on pasikalbėk, you pick certain topics, the therapist picks certain topics, and you are offered a specialist where there's the most match between what you're expecting and what the person can offer. So this is how they are solving it. In another situations, what also helps is seeing all specialists described according to the same criteria. I think that also helps, but it's a problem in itself, because then you have to be on those marketplaces. And it still doesn't, reduce the risk that you will not click, and it still happens, So I think it's definitely a problem.
But it is something that you can improve with time, right?
Okay.
So I do work for a marketplace company.
Yeah.
So I do have some expertise.
That's what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert in therapy marketplaces or in marketplaces that connect humans who want to do a certain skill work with other humans. So I'm not an expert in that topic. Let's make that disclaimer. But I think that, as marketplace improves, there are opportunities to improve how that connection happens. Like if you're successfully growing a marketplace, you can discover what leads to successful connections between supply and demand.
Okay.
And you can discover, well, in this specific case, we're talking about therapist marketplace, right? Maybe you can discover certain questions that you need to ask to both sides to make sure that connection works. It will require a lot of experimentation. I think the challenge then with this specific marketplace would be that, like, you know, in Vinted, we have a ton of supply and a ton of demand. There's a lot of transactions going on. And then in the marketplace for therapists, well, maybe that number is lower, which makes experimentation more difficult. And then you need to depend more on experts who will give you that insight quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that something that would be maybe a bit difficult to grasp if you didn't go to therapy is that the whatever the therapist is, male or female, can matter with in whatever you will click with them or not. Based on on your relationship with your parents in the childhood.
Sure. Like, yeah, and
that's relevant information.
Mm-hmm.
That's something. I think if you would ask someone who wants to go to therapy, they might not be able to figure out by themselves whatever they need to go to a male therapist or a female therapist. It's, you know, you need to be already a bit self-aware to answer that question in a way that would lead to a good outcome. But maybe there are ways when you're creating a therapy marketplace to create certain questions that would lead you to that will lead to a good outcome without asking that question directly.
Yeah. Just inferring from certain information that is provided by both parties. Yeah.
Maybe asking something about the relationship with your parents, but some specific questions. There must be ways to figure this out to have a high confidence of good outcome. But
in terms of the therapeutic process that you experienced, were there any things like that? I don't want, once again, I'm not expecting you to criticize the person that you worked with. I'm talking about the process. And the process oftentimes depends on the technique and philosophy that the person follows. And I'm sure that because you had specific partnership, I understand it might be difficult for you to see the difference, but it can be where, for example, in a psychodynamic session, there might be a lot of silence, a lot of space for thinking, a lot of exploratory questions. What does it mean, this and that? How is it related to this and that? Is it related to this and that? There's a lot of exploration. Whereas, for example, in cognitive behavioral therapy, there is less silence, more education, more maybe advice, the difference between anxiety and fear is this and this. Or maybe, okay, from what you're saying, it sounds like you're, that's a assumption or that's a bias. So it's more active, you know. And different people like different things, that's okay. But from your perspective, Mindaugas, what you experienced as an engineer at your core, what were maybe those things that were a bit annoying to you and that could be also improved upon? Anything that comes to your mind?
Yeah, I have a hard time recalling something that I found annoying.
Okay.
The process that I experienced was closer to the first one you named. It was more silence, a lot of exploratory questions. And that process worked quite well for me. I think of myself in being, you know, introspective.
Mm-hmm.
As an engineer, I also like to think of the world as a system and think of myself as a system. And I like to find, you know, one of the things that I enjoyed the most when I was a software engineer, like there are a lot of activities you do as a software engineer. You build new stuff, you change existing stuff, etc. But what I really got a lot of just happiness and joy from is debugging. But debugging means finding that thing that that causes us a problem, like finding that specific line of code that is the root cause of this specific problem. Like, I really enjoyed that, like just trying to, and this requires understanding the system, understanding how different elements connect in the system, and then figuring out, okay, this is where we need to look. This is the line that we need to change, and then everything will fit neatly into place. I really enjoyed doing that as a software engineer. And then how that connects to therapy is that I was really debugging myself through therapy, like really trying to understand myself better and how different elements of my life and how I structure my thoughts and how my childhood influenced me connect. And like, I don't have a perfect picture because it's really difficult to have a perfect picture, but I think I have a better picture of after therapy. So that process, that explorative process where I was asked open questions and I was led through an exploration of myself really worked for me because it was kind of an activity that I enjoy already.
Yes, like, so is it related to exploratory testing in a way? Looking for a root cause, these metaphors, it seems that they are relevant in this case, and they are based on the idea that there is that root cause. And unfortunate reality is that the root cause, if you look like at a system and at the hierarchical levels, for example, you look in psychology, there's the environment, there are the behaviors, the habits, then you might have values, you might have beliefs, you might have identity, and you even might have, you know, spirituality. And the thing is that whereas in a system you might identify, let's say, a certain glitch or mistake, oftentimes in, maybe it's also in software engineering, educate me, but in psychology the root cause is on the different levels, and you talk about it on those different levels, it makes sense then. But the problem is that sometimes people expect that they will resolve a certain conflict in the childhood, it's that psychoanalytic fantasy of Freud, and then you will get that insight and then you will be free. Well,
yeah, so absolutely. So I was referring that the process is similar, that I enjoy the process because of that. But I do agree that the systems you're debugging in these two cases are quite different. Mm-hmm. So in software, there are a lot of times that you can find that line of code that you need to change.
Yeah.
In other cases, maybe you need to, okay, the root cause is bad architecture. We need to redo the architecture, but it's still something you can abstract to a single thing that is causing the issue. And in human systems, maybe it's true that you can find that single root
sometimes
cause.
Sometimes it's possible. Yeah.
Sometimes, maybe, right? But in a lot of cases with humans and with human systems, it's a lot more difficult. And it's more like, okay, this is influencing in some way, this is influencing in some way. It's a lot more complex and it's not just one thing. And that is a very, very clear difference between software systems and human systems.
Totally. By the way, speaking of Freud once again, and it ties to something we discussed before this conversation. It's about conflict. Freud had an idea that we have certain intrapersonal, like conflicts within ourselves, that if they are resolved, as we said, you might be more free. And for that, you need insight into your unconscious mind, basically. So it's like going into the back end of the system and looking how the servers interact, how the information processing happens, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, these conflicts, intrapersonal conflicts, where, for example, I don't like myself, or I don't like how I look, or, for example, I see myself one way, but I feel different, you know, identity issues. So these are like those intrapersonal conflicts, and they can be, you know, they are difficult, and it's difficult to deal with them, especially alone, you know. Mm-hmm. And I see the same way in interpersonal conflicts or conflicts between people that I guess some people, and maybe me included, I had that fantasy that it's possible to have a constructive conversation. That doesn't happen with my girlfriend. We have a lot of conversations, some are constructive, some not very constructive. But, you know, I still think that it's possible to, you know, if it's possible, if conflict interpersonally and intrapersonally, it's not a good thing. So we should definitely look for ways how to solve them, resolve them, avoid situations where conflict happens intrapersonal or interpersonal in the first place. So that's my thinking. That's my bias. Now, when we were talking once, you said that conflict is great, that we have to get into conflict. And I also respect that because you get to know each other, you express your opinions. But for some people, conflict is associated with some, you know, some discomfort, some emotional tension. And I guess if there's not that tension, discomfort, so it's not conflict, the way I see it, you know. So what's your take on conflict, both intrapersonal, interpersonal? Why do you think it's great that we have those conflicts? What do you think?
Yeah, so I view conflict a bit differently, right?
Okay.
So even for intrapersonal conflict, I think that if you're able to recognize, if I'm able to recognize that there's conflict in me, I already interpret that as a positive step, because I think the worst situation is anxiety. So I have anxiety. I don't understand why I'm having that anxiety, and already in identifying that there is a conflict that needs to be solved, for me, that's already a positive step.
Identifying the conflict. But if there would be no conflict, there would be nothing to identify, logically speaking.
I think conflict is inevitable. So
Fair enough. So if it's inevitable, so fair enough. But why do you think it's good then? Suffering is inevitable, but it doesn't mean that suffering is good.
Yeah, but for me, conflict is a positive step towards reaching a resolution.
Okay.
So I don't see conflict as a cause, like something else is a cause. You could experience things like anxiety that is bad, like anxiety is not comfortable, and I view conflict as a positive step towards reaching a resolution. Like, to me, conflict is a process that you do, that you go through to reach something good. And that's why I see conflict as a good thing. And, you know, right now I'm talking a lot about intrapersonal conflict, but when it's between people, when there's conflict between people, I view it the same way. There is an issue, that the fact that there's an issue, and like, for example, me and you are disagreeing about something, that's bad. Like, we have different opinions. Maybe we actually should be aligned. Maybe let's say we work together, we should be pulling the cart in one direction, but we're not, because, you know, we're disagreeing. And then conflict itself, us going into a room and trying to figure out the truth, mm-hmm. is a positive act. It is uncomfortable in a lot of cases. Conflict is uncomfortable because conflict, well, the act itself, putting ourselves out there, stating our true opinions, can be uncomfortable. And then conflict can end up with us changing our mind, and change is uncomfortable. So I do understand how conflict is uncomfortable, but I still view it as a positive thing in the end. And having conflict and resolving conflict is a good thing. It leads to better things.
That's to what I agree, because there is that reality of conflict. There's no doubt that it is. We experience it. It's discomforting. Yes, it can be discomforting. Many times it is discomforting. And the fact that we're able, as you say, to identify and solve it, that's awesome. Another thing, what I'm taking from your discussion is that it's like, metaphorically speaking, the only way to see our boundaries is for those boundaries to get in touch. And when we are disagreeing, in a way, it's like two objects touching each other in not maybe the most comfortable way. And I agree with this concept. But now where I'm coming from is, I guess, conflict is a symptom. I don't see it as a method. I see it as a symptom, and I will tell you why, and let it pick apart my argument if you can. So, you know, it will sound maybe spiritual, metaphysic, but I think there is science to that, is that when I'm getting into conflict with you, I'm not getting into conflict with you per se. I'm getting into conflict with humanity. So I'm a human. I'm a human. You're a human. We are more similar than we are different. And my attempt to get into conflict, it can be seen as my attempt to be less human. And practically speaking, if I would put more attention not on trying to communicate what I want to say, not trying to communicate what I need, but try to identify me or my needs in you. For example, a couple, they get into conflict and they don't like something about each other. The thing that brings them together is the conflict. The conflict is the enemy that they can face together. So what I'm saying is that conflict is a system. It's how I see it, is our inability to see ourselves in the other person. And if I would start from a different position, from a position of empathy and understanding, and less from my ability to try to create very strong boundaries, I think that there would be less conflict. And I think that we would be even better with less of it. But that's just my maybe philosophical take on that. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. But at the same time, like, we need to create boundaries. Like, we need to understand ourselves. We need to understand what is important for us. And we need then to create boundaries so that that is what those things that are important to us would still be there. So which then leads to conflict being inevitable. But at least in my mind, I do understand that being more empathetic is also a good way towards, how would I say that, solving the potential conflicts preemptively. Like, empathy is definitely a good thing in my eyes. But there needs to be a balance, right? Like, and part of the reason why I went into therapy is because I was sacrificing too much of myself in my relationship. So I can very easily understand how a person can be so empathetic, so self-sacrificing, that they'll lose a part of themselves in their relationship. And then I needed to go through therapy to find more of myself again, understand myself better, and then to learn how to put those boundaries back again where they totally need to be.
Totally. I hear you, Mendogas. And I guess the idea I'm trying to bring up in this discussion is that we need to discover ourselves, to define ourselves, so that we eventually would be able to abandon it for the sake of seeing the common humanity. So, of course, if you don't identify yourself, your values, your needs, your expectations from world, expectations from others, your thinking patterns, it's difficult to realize, so what is a human being? What is a human mind? But I think that when we do this job, and it's an important job, I think that it's important then to realize that, okay, it's just something that ties us together. I'm not that different. And then see that similarity, that to see that common humanity. And if that's the case, so yeah, I think the world would be a better place. But so
yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. I agree with that, okay. Definitely.
Okay. Okay, Mindaugas. So yeah, we covered a lot of ground today, right? So I enjoyed our conversation. And anything you would like to, maybe certain ideas or takeaways that you would like to leave before we end our conversation, what they would be?
I think the last thoughts you spoke about are very relevant and very related to a lot of the things that we've talked about today. I think that if I could wish one thing to those who are gonna be listening to us, is that, you know, find yourself, understand yourself, and I wish everyone to understand themselves better. I think that as humanity overall, we would be better off if more people really understood themselves better.
I think that it's a good summary of what we discussed basically from all of the topics we covered. So it was a pleasure, Mindaugas, talking to you, and hope to see you next time. Okay.
Absolutely. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mindaugas.